but I think we're joined now by Zafar Benkash. Are you there, Zafar?
Hello, Phil. Yes, I'm with you.
Well, thank you very much, Zafar, for being our guest. I want to congratulate you. There was a Solidarity for Kashmir event in Mississauga, and you hosted it, and it was heartening to see a turnout, and also people addressing a subject which we can't get the Canadian Parliament to take an interest in. We have no. I'm not aware of an elected official who even acknowledged that we have a situation which, and the government of Pakistan, the government of India, two nuclear-armed states, have now, because of the initiative or action of Prime Minister Modi, changing all the rules about the Indian occupied sector of Kashmir, we're really, you know, in political terms, that's like a brink of war situation. But not a word from our Prime Minister that I'm aware of, and certainly not from Parliament. Why is that?
Yes, you're right. Unfortunately, Canadian politicians of different political stripes, with a very, very minor exception of a few NDP MPs, others have been basically tiptoeing through this issue and keeping their fingers crossed and not saying anything, despite the fact that there have been a very large number of petitions sent out to the government and to leaders of the other political parties, urging them to take note of this very, very serious situation that has developed in Indian-occupied Kashmir since August the 5th. In fact, it existed even earlier than that, but it became much worse on August the 5th of 2019, when the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi unilaterally abrogated various provisions of the Indian Constitution, particularly Articles 35A and Article 370. Now, 35A actually predates even the creation of India. This article was passed by the Constituent Assembly in Kashmir in 1927. Mm-hmm. And this article stipulated that people that are not of Kashmiri origin cannot purchase land or acquire property in Kashmir. And the reason behind this article was because they feared that since Kashmir is a predominantly Muslim area, it is a very pleasant area in terms of temperature and so on. It's a mountainous area. That if outsiders started to purchase property in Kashmir, then in due course, the Kashmiris would be reduced to a minority. So they did not want to be reduced to a minority in their own land, and that article, Article 35A, was passed by the Constituent Assembly in Kashmir in 1927, mm-hmm. and then it was incorporated into the Indian Constitution as well. Mm-hmm. When India unilaterally occupied Kashmir in October of 1947. Mm-hmm. Now, the other article, which is referred to as Article 370, this was worked on in 1949 and then finally put into the Indian Constitution in 1954, which stated that Kashmir has special autonomous status. Whatever arrangements Kashmir has with India are only temporary arrangements, and that India cannot unilaterally change the status of Kashmir because it, according to United Nations Security Council resolutions, the state of Jammu and Kashmir is disputed territory. Its future has to be determined by the wishes of the people, of the Kashmiri people, of whom there are now 12 million or so, 8 million under Indian occupation, and the other 4 million on the Pakistani side, where incidentally, on the Pakistani side, the people are very happy. There is absolutely no trouble or problem or anything because they wish to be part of Pakistan. But India refuses to allow the Kashmiris under its occupation to hold that referendum so that the Kashmiris can decide their own future. And so,
and that's a UN resolution to which Canada contributed, believed in, and advocated.
Absolutely.
And now, now it looks the other way while this is going on.
Exactly. In fact, it was General Andrew McNaughton, who happened to be the president of the Security Council in 1949, when this matter actually came before the Security Council in January of 1948, and it was India that brought the matter to the Security Council because it was India was on the verge of losing control of Kashmir, the remainder of Kashmir, because there was an uprising against the ruler of the state at the time. People obviously were expecting that the ruler would opt to join Pakistan according to the partition plan. When he hesitated, the people rose up against him. India, of course, rushed its troops over there, but even these troops were being driven away, and the Indian government at the time realized that it would not be able to suppress the uprising of the people. Mm-hmm. So it brought the matter to the Security Council, and then, as you mentioned, Andrew McNaughton, who happened to be the president of the Security Council, because Canada at that time was a rotating member of the Security Council. Incidentally, something that our current government, led by Justin Trudeau, is trying to win back that seat, and he's traveling across Africa, drumming up support for that. He's, of course, competing with Norway, and I'm not quite sure whether Canada would be able to secure that two-year rotating seat. But regardless, in 1949, Canada was a rotating member, and it happened to be, General McNaughton happened to be the president of the Security Council, and he was the one who drafted this resolution, which was accepted both by India and Pakistan and by the Kashmiri people, that there should be a referendum held in Kashmir so that the people can decide their own future.
You know, maybe we should help the Canadian Parliament out by asking them to implement the McNaughton program.
Absolutely.
I think say this it's the Canadian initiative, a great Canadian. Why don't we support it?
Exactly. And this is what, you know, I was in Pakistan and Azad Jammu and Kashmir, which is the Pakistani side of Kashmir, with the delegation of people. And it is incredible that, you know, the number of people, particularly in Azad Kashmir, and also there are tens of thousands of refugees that have had to flee from Indian-occupied Kashmir. They are in refugee camps, about 40,000 of them. Others that have come over the years, that number in millions, that have now basically settled in the rest of Pakistan. But these refugees that we visited, all of them were absolutely adamant about this question of the referendum that they want to be held in Indian-occupied Kashmir. Mm-hmm. And also many of them, of course, I'm not talking about each and every one of them, quite a few of them are unfortunately very, very simple, ordinary, you know, people, shopkeepers and so on. They don't know much about politics. But others that are even sort of, you know, slightly educated, they are aware of the history that it was a Canadian and it was Canada that had spearheaded the Security Council resolutions, and they still repose huge trust in the Canadian government, and they want Canada to take the initiative so that that resolution, or not one, actually there were more than a dozen resolutions that were passed over the number of years, starting from 1948 going all the way up to 1957, and each and every one of those resolutions reiterated that a referendum should be held in Kashmir. Wow. So these people, these Kashmiri refugees that have come from Indian-occupied Kashmir and are now on the Pakistani side of Kashmir, they are constantly asking for those resolutions to be acted upon so that the people can determine their own future.
We're speaking to Zafar Bengash, crescent.icit-digital.org, Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought at Zafar Bengash, and who's written, by the way, a number of remarkable books, particularly about the Saud royal family. But I want to ask you today also about the matter of what we're seeing between Turkey and Syria at this moment. My understanding is that the Turkish government and the Russian government were going to provide some sort of neutral corridor and try to facilitate a disengagement of forces. But there's another, but what is developing, some are reporting that Turkish armed forces are moving in such numbers that they may be trying to block the liberation of Idlib by the Syrian army.
Yes, unfortunately, it is one of those very, very sad developments and also very dangerous developments that Turkey is involved in. Number one, Turkish forces are in Syria without the consent of the Syrian government. Secondly, Turkey has occupied a significant swath of Syrian territory in the northwest of the country. And today, and in fact, over the last week, there have been various skirmishes. Last week, Turkey is reported to have lost 8 soldiers, and a number of them were injured in Syria. And today, another 5 or 6 of them were killed. And the Turkish government has obviously reacted with great anger. They are threatening various kinds of retaliations, etc. Mm-hmm. The fact is that Syria is trying to liberate its own territory. And I don't think that that should be beyond anybody's comprehension, that that's not an illegal thing.
Yes, a necessary thing.
Exactly, that any government whose territory is occupied by foreign forces or by mercenaries that are backed by foreign countries, etc., the government of that particular country would try to liberate its own territory. And yet, regrettably, we see Turkey that is involved over there, and it's trying to insist on maintaining a large swath of territory under its own control on the spurious pretext that if it doesn't, then Syrian refugees would flood into Turkey. Now, let me share for the benefit of your listeners that any territory that has been liberated by the Syrian government, the people have been quite happy over there. In fact, any territory that was under the control of the Syrian government, the people went about their normal business. Schools and colleges and hospitals and other businesses were open. Areas or cities that were under the control of so-called Syrian rebels, these were essentially mercenaries that were backed by foreign governments, whether it's the United States or Turkey or Qatar or Israel or Saudi Arabia, these countries. In those areas, there was no normal life activity. Schools and colleges were closed. People were being humiliated. There were no courts. There were these terrorists, chopping people's heads off, etc. And yet, somehow we see that this situation that the terrorists were perpetrating against the Syrian people was presented as somehow being a normal situation.
Yes.
And what the Syrian government was doing to provide for its people was considered to be abnormal. To give you an example of 4 years ago or 3 years ago, in December of 2016, the city of Aleppo, half of that city, the western half, was under Syrian government control, and the second half, the eastern half, was under the control of rebels, or the terrorists. When the Syrian army moved in to liberate that territory, immediately we started hearing these stories about, these 400,000 people are going to be massacred, and they are going to be in, there is going to be a bloodbath, and the Syrian army is going to do this crime or that crime.
Yes.
And yet, at the end of December of 2016, when eastern Aleppo was liberated, the people welcomed the Syrian army with joy.
Mm-hmm.
And today, the city of
Aleppo celebrated Christmas, is my memory.
Yes.
Something they were not, the Christians were, had not been allowed to do that under the terrorist control.
Exactly. And today, the whole of Aleppo is united, and tens of thousands of people that had fled the city because of fighting have come back. and they have resumed their normal lives. They have started to rebuild their homes and their lives, and the schools are now open, the hospitals are open, their businesses are open. And as you pointed out, after the liberation, for the first time, the people of Aleppo, the Christians that were residing there, were able to celebrate Christmas. So once again, we are seeing the same situation in these pockets of Idlib that are still under the control of these mercenaries, that the Turkish army is preventing their defeat and preventing the Syrian government from reclaiming its own territory.
Yes. And Zafra, lastly on that, there is an agreement, and some of these states are talking to each other. They're sort of the guarantors. My memory is that the Islamic Republic, Turkey, Russia, perhaps another, I don't remember. But the agreement says that the territorial integrity of Syria is to be restored. So Turkey actually has agreed to that.
Yes.
And now they're behaving as though they're schizophrenic. But they have a problem. Certainly they have to explain themselves.
Exactly. This is what is referred to as the Astana Agreement. This was drawn up in Astana. Several rounds of discussions have taken place over this. And as you said, Turkey, Iran, and Russia guaranteed that Syria's territorial integrity is to be respected, and that the Syrian government and Syrian forces would have control of their territory, and that refugees would be allowed to return to their homes. As I mentioned earlier, tens of thousands of Syrian refugees have returned to their homes in areas that have been liberated from the clutches of these foreign mercenaries. And regrettably, what Turkey is doing today actually benefits the United States and Israel, which is because both of these countries want to keep Syria destabilized so that it benefits the benefit accrues to them.
Yes.
And whereas I don't really understand why Turkey is playing this particular role, because it is really not in the larger interest of Turkey itself either. And certainly it would benefit Turkey and would be beneficial for its long-term interests if it were to settle its policy with Syria, because before the war broke out in Syria, or the war was launched against the Syrian government, Turkey and Syria were very close to each other. They had very strong trade relations. They had very strong cultural relations. Mm-hmm. And Turkey looked upon Syria as a window to the Arab world. But because of that very, very unfortunate policy that Turkey adopted under Erdogan, Turkey has got itself into a very, very messy situation.
Yes.
And regrettably, because of the fact that he has a big ego, almost the size of our friend south of the border, that he simply cannot extricate himself from the mess he has got himself into.
I'm really glad you pinpointed it. I think this might be one occasion where it is actually the personality of the leader that's causing the problem. Zafar Bengash, it's a pleasure talking to you. It's very informative. And I think this problem is one which we're going to have to come back to regularly, because this is going to have to go one direction or the other soon.
Yes, of course.
Thank you very much.
It's my great pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, bye-bye. This is the Taylor Report. It is CIUT 89.5 FM. I want to remind you, tomorrow, Tuesday, there is a film showing in Hamilton, 24 Main Street, at the and it's sponsored by the Hamilton Voices of Palestine film series. The film is by Nicholas Wadimoff, and it is a Beth Satoon-sponsored film as well. The film is the Apollo of Gaza. And I understand it's a somewhat humorous film about a very serious subject. And that's Tuesday, 7 o'clock, New Vision United Church. And we hope there'll be a good turnout for that. There's going to be a political discussion of the film and people's thoughts about Gaza, I think, afterwards. I think we can take a break, maybe have some music, and we will come back with Paul Skolnick in Montreal.